Do I share that? Yeah, when it's appropriate, when it feels, you know, in line with what I'm encountering. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't match the suffering of some of my patients. It would be folly for me to try to suggest that I understand from having been there what they're going through. But on the other hand, if it's more or less in line of it, I'll share something. Yeah. Microphone.
People who might sort of come up for air and almost make it, but not make it all the way through.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I've always thought there's the necessity of respecting the dignity of people who can't survive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we must do that.
We have a question here.
Yeah.
Right here.
Just a fairly simple thought. When you were talking about Dr. Lenihan, you quoted the phrase, I accept myself as I am. And that sort of rang a bell with me. And I said, this sounds important. But wait a minute. If I accept myself as I am I improving? Am I working toward improvement? On the other hand, if I don't accept myself as I am, what does that mean? Is there a way you could expand on that a little bit? I haven't figured it out.
I haven't figured it out either. I mean, if we don't accept ourselves as we are, then we can't move forward, right? Because we're always thwarting ourselves, or we're always condemning ourselves, or trying to improve something, or whatever. So we can't get off first base, so to speak. So self-acceptance, radical self-acceptance, as Lenihan says, is a crucial element in this. Pardon? As a first step, yeah.
Don, I have a question. Janelle, back here in the back. Okay. I'm going to use my privileges holder of the microphone.
Okay.
What about those who go through trauma and don't have time to form defenses, don't have time for the story, don't have time for that initial plug? I'm thinking of the youth that I work with. I work in a transfer high school in East Harlem, and all of the students I work with don't have stories and symbols. They will just say, I'm upset because I held my cousin in my arms as he died after he was shot in the face. And I say, God, when was that? And they say, oh, last year. But it's the one-year anniversary. They don't have anything mediating that, and it's constant. They've all grown up in incredible poverty and violence.
Yes.
And I think this is becoming more and more the case in our country. I do not think it is limited to East Harlem,
mm-hmm.
Where people are suffering so many traumas and losses without time for even that initial defense.
Right.
And what's the, when they don't have those thorn bushes even yet to break through, what's the, you know, there are some therapeutic techniques that say you need to help them create a narrative. And there are others that say, no, I'm curious to know your thoughts.
Well, if you took that child and showed him a film that would duplicate his experience and provide a story for it, there might be a real click there. Might not be. I mean, what you're really talking about is the poverty of the imagination, right? We need to try to bring imagination to these events. This is the role of art, of film. I mean, I can't tell you how many times a patient of mine has been healed, partly healed by a film that gave a story to their, or partial narrative to their otherwise just sort of numb.
So
trauma.
Do you see the thorn bushes, the first defense, the plug, as important, an important first step that you must...
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Here's a question.
We have several hands up over here.
Yeah.
Is it possible that in order to emerge from the dis, there has to be a willingness to go through a layer of self-loathing that the person never knew was there?
Mm-hmm. Often, yes. Often the conviction of personal badness is so deeply ingrained that... That was the case for my patient that I described. She really had to get to that. And when she could confess it, she broke into tears. You see, that little girl in her was burdened and weighted down by that conviction. When she could share the conviction, then she could get to the little girl underneath it. Yes, in the back.
First, a comment and a resource for the gentleman who was talking about not being able to make progress. Mm-hmm. There is a really phenomenal book that I read recently called The Spirituality of Imperfection, Storytelling in the Search for Meaning by Ernest Kurtz and Catherine Ketchum. Came out in 1992. And they take 100 stories from 12 of the world's religions and weave the narrative about how human beings have made meaning and tried to understand both the limitations on this side as well as our ability to reach higher. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it. It's a brilliant piece of work. The question that I had was related to the previous commentary about suicide. Mm-hmm. I think we can't overlook some biological glitches in some people's neurochemistry. Mm-hmm. In David Eagleman's current book called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, he talks about both genetic as well as pathogenic tumors and stuff like that that will limit a person's ability to make choices, either in terms of violence to themselves or violence to others. And I guess the caution here is that we can never judge by the behavior that we see, because we really don't know a lot of times what's going on. It may not just be the narrative that they can't get to. It may, in fact, be a biological glitch.
Yeah, I'm certainly sympathetic with your comment that we can't judge. We often don't know. Biology plays a role. You know, there's some people that seem to be born with a level of aggressive energies in their psychology that makes it very hard to mother the baby. We can't put this all on mothers either. It's a complicated story. And we don't know all the factors. We don't know the prenatal factors. We don't know the biological factors. It's a very complicated story. What I'm talking about here is a spectrum or portion of that reality that has a meaning if we can find it, and it's really important that we struggle to find it.
Yes. Thank you.
Then we got to have the microphone down here. There's some very patient people down here.
I see the knot.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not sure I can articulate this because I struggle with how to talk about, even though internally I think I'm clear, how to talk about the perpetrator, protector, predator that is archetypal, that is in our human experience, that is internalized, and that is in the world.
And that's invisible.
Okay. But I'm thinking more about how in my own personal experience, first of all, important to know maybe is that I've always been very afraid of good people, the people who deny the existence of evil and certain things, the people who rationalize and don't want to face the pain or suffering of knowing that these things happen. They are the people who enable in my mind, and it scares me. So now I see in myself, and in the culture maybe, I'm not sure how to read this, this movement towards stretching the lens of compassion to include the dark angel, to look at characters like Hannibal Lecter or Dexter or vampires, and to bring some human dimension to our understanding of how they became. Jerry Sandusky even, despite his own inability to go there and hold in it. And
what do you think of those efforts to stretch the lens?
I am fascinated and And I'm also fascinated with the depth at which, in the case of, for instance, Dexter, they're being dealt with. I mean, I don't know how much of the audience is paying attention from a Jungian perspective to a character like Mos Def, who comes in talking about angels and salvation and that even you, and sees him and knows who he is. So this brings up the next question. It seems to happen when there's a character, like in Hannibal, who has such empathy for the perpetrator. And that scares me too, because I see myself as someone raised by a perpetrator to have empathy for the perpetrator. I hope I'm not getting way off the topic. But...
Well, there are about four or five topics in what you just said.
I know there are. I'm sorry. But I know, that was my problem. I couldn't distill. I couldn't get it down. But is there something in there you can respond
to?
Yeah,
okay. Let's talk about... you know, if you're a victim of such an abuser, of course you're going to have a full spectrum of reactions, including rage and great pain and suffering at the hands of this abuser. That's going to be a different story than the overall approach that I'm taking here, which is somewhere in this archetypal story, there's a human story. And it may be a human story that never could get begotten to. For example, Hitler. Hitler was beaten to the point of unconsciousness repeatedly by his father. He would routinely count the blows. I remember somehow the number 32. And he steeled himself so that he would feel nothing. And he grew up incredibly intolerant of vulnerable people who cried and wept and felt things. And he was, as we know, the perpetrator of incredible collective violence and death on the face of this planet. He also cried when his canary died. So that it's as if this split between his hardened, violent nature and some piece of him that was left, you know. Now, I don't know, I had a conversation about this with somebody over dinner or lunch or something, but Alice Miller, who is one of the people that's writing today who really understands trauma and the abuse that kids suffer, wrote Hitler up as a case. And she was very aware that he was a survivor of incredible emotional abuse and trauma. And that this goes some distance to explaining the heinous crimes that he committed. We have to factor that in. We have to allow that to be part of our understanding. Same with this kid that mowed down all these children in Newtown. We have to make an effort to try to grasp what that was. That doesn't mean we excuse it. That doesn't mean we don't take action against it. That doesn't mean we are sympathetic to it, but it means we have to try to understand, because we're looking into the face there of some kind of suffering. Now, Jim Hillman, my colleague, and recently deceased, actually, has written extensively about analytical psychology. He's done a great service in linking us to the arts, which is one of the places where we heal our traumas, to modern movements in architecture, city planning, and all the rest of it. But in The Soul's Code, he explains Hitler's heinous and violent criminal activity in terms of a bad seed. Now, to me, this is very dangerous territory, because you've stepped then out of the human, interhuman, all too human dimension into a totalistic category, an evil, bad seed, and you are now explaining human behavior based on fundamentalistic categories. The same when Scott Peck wanted to create a category for malignant narcissists, right, to enshrine evil in the DSM. To me, there's a slippage there. And as Jungians, we really understand the two dimensions. We're really talking about totalistic categories, fundamentalistic categories on the one hand, archetypal categories, and human categories. Right. We can say that somebody is possessed by evil. No problem. But that somebody still ought to interest us in there. Unless, of course, we're being victimized by that somebody, and then we just have to take action.
And then just quickly on back to Marcia Linehan, it seems so significant to me in that article that mentioned also was that another teenager who turned out to be best friends with her while she was in long treatment turned out to also be a brilliant therapist, Seaburn Fisher, so that Seaburn Fisher, she's one of the developers of neurotherapy and advocates of neurotherapy, but they were best friends while they were in treatment together. And so I wonder what role that mirroring and being seen had to do with her capacity to...
Very good question. Was that in the Times article?
Yes, it was.
Really?
Yeah, and she works with Bessel van der Kolk. Seaburn does.
Okay, very interesting. I'll have to go back to the article because I don't remember that. Okay, down here we've got several people.
So we have time for one more question, and then I'm afraid we have to go to dinner. So, Dr. Kalshad, I'm going to make you choose.
This gentleman in the front row here, or the second row.
We get two microphones.
Thank you. I was thinking about the issue of soul retrieval and how by getting past the defenses and the story to the pain that underlies it is a way of healing, helping with healing. And I also had an opportunity once to sit in on a soul retrieval ceremony in which the shaman traveled on the vibration of a drum to get information about someone's past and images that were brought back to discuss with the person. And I'm wondering about the relationship between that soul retrieval and the soul retrieval that is done in a more... I guess, I hate to say mainstream because I think Jungian treatment and that kind of depth approach
is not
quite mainstream.
It's not mainstream, for sure.
I was reading about Jung as he was writing some of his papers. He knew in advance that Freud was going to reject him for some of the things that he was about to publish.
Yeah.
And so I don't see that as mainstream, but I'm curious about the relationship between the kind of soul, the different types of soul retrieval.
Well, I think it's a very good question. And remember that archaic healing practices, practice in shamanism, were at a time before we knew about the psyche. As Jung used to say, religion is where the psyche was before we made it an object of scientific investigation. So these forms of healing were very effective in a religiously, spiritually embedded culture where it was understood that the soul left the body in times of great stress and trouble and could be recovered by the agency of a shaman. And the shaman was to the culture the way Hermes Mercurius is to the inner world of Jungian psychology, right? He could go up the pole and into the other world and he could find the soul and retrieve it. The thing that's missing there in terms of modern practice is that it's done for you by another person. And so we don't know, I haven't been present in a shamanic culture, you know, to know exactly how this... It's possible that when the soul comes back, the person experiences a cathartic release of tears and healing in that way. But in modern psychotherapy, we would want the person whose soul has been lost to participate more.
That was one of my concerns in having seen that the relationship was absent,
right.
the ongoing struggle
right.
to retrieve what the pieces of the soul or what has been lost is missing in that one time, or sometimes several different occasions of right. Journeying.
Yep, same concern I have. Okay, thank you all. We'll see you tomorrow.